As Jan Sillars, Christy Giles' husband, attempted to retrace Christy's moves the night before she died of an overdose, he was still troubled by the stop at an apartment located in the Pico Robertson area on Olympic Boulevard. After posting about the location on Instagram, Jan was alerted to some rumors about a man who lived there, David Pierce. And Jan had a horrible feeling that someone had done something to the two women. Let's bring back Jan. What were you able to find out in the first few hours of tracking Christy's movements?
As soon as I landed back in LA, some friends picked me up from the airport and we went straight to the Culver City emergency room, spoke to some of the Culver City detectives, spoke to some of the nurses. And really, I was just trying to figure out what was going on, why, you know, a perfectly healthy 24, 25-year-old shouldn't be suddenly dying. So obviously something very wrong happened. And I was determined to get to the bottom of that. And on social media, I posted about the address that she had spent the night at and most of the morning and the afternoon. And I reached out to my network of people and asked if anybody knows anybody that lives at this specific address. And very quickly, a lot of people replied that David Pierce lives there and that he is a pretty unsavory person from all reports. And I kind of passed this information on to the detectives. And that night, the detectives visited him, from my understanding, and tried to search his property. And at first, he told them no. And then he let them in. I guess, you know, my understanding of what the events that took place is that he dropped off Christy first at the Culver City emergency room. And then 2 hours later, he dropped off Hilda at a different emergency room to try and avoid suspicion that these two cases were in any way connected and very possibly, you know, cost Hilda her life too by waiting 2 hours to take her in when both girls were struggling and not breathing. And so the detectives on the case started investigating and seeing that a lot of other people had been affected by this person and started putting a case together.
According to Do-Hee Kim, who was with Christy and Hilda that night at the warehouse party, Pierce provided the pair with what looked to be cocaine and they consumed it. Other texts between Christy and Hilda showed they'd also used cocaine earlier in the night at the art exhibit. But what happened once they got back to Pierce's apartment? Let's bring back Danielle Radin, an LA-based journalist for CBS Los Angeles. Danielle, first, what else can you tell us about the location of the apartment?
Pico Robertson is an area in Los Angeles, south of West Hollywood and Beverly Hills. The apartment is on Olympic Boulevard. It's a very busy street with a constant flow of traffic. There are a lot of hospitals in the area.
A police affidavit said that Pierce's apartment was 3.1 miles away from Southern California Hospital, where Christy was discovered. The Kaiser Permanente Hospital, where Hilda was discovered, is 1.7 miles from his apartment. The closest hospital to that apartment is Cedars-Sinai, which is 1.2 miles away.
On November 14th, 2021, Jonathan Vander Lee, a homicide detective with LAPD's Western Bureau, was assigned to investigate Christy's death. Within hours of Christy's death, LAPD visited the location from Christy's phone ping, and sure enough, they found a black Prius parked in the back of the property with license plates removed. Detectives believe it was the same vehicle that dropped both women off at the hospital. Police observed Brant Osborne inside the apartment and eventually spoke to both Osborne and Pierce. According to the search affidavit obtained by LA Times, Osborne told police, "I didn't give them anything, okay? I don't live like that. He said the women were making noises, but he figured he would give them a couple hours and they'd come out of it. But Osborne said it seems like they were getting progressively worse, and he panicked because he's never been in a situation like this before. Osborne also told police he and Pierce didn't know Christy and Hilda, admitting they didn't bring the women to the same hospital because we didn't know how that would look. Inside the house, the sheets had been stripped from one of the beds. Police found two scales in the bathroom, a safe in Pierce's room with small Ziploc baggies, numerous pornographic trophies that say AVN, Adult Video Movie Award, as well as an action figure of Ron Jeremy's and a signed pornographic DVD of Ron Jeremy's. According to police, the Prius in the back had no plates, black rims, and matched the video of Culver City Hospital surveillance footage, as well as the photos the security guard took of the vehicle. There was also an Arizona license plate near the car and a box of money, which Pierce claims to be $20,000 to $30,000. Danielle, what did the police find out from neighbors and other witnesses they spoke to?
Before Jan even knows what happened to Christy exactly, he posts her last known location from the Find My iPhone app on Instagram, pleading with people, "Does anybody know who lives here on West Olympic Boulevard?" He said people start immediately messaging him, saying the person who lives there is suspicious. They say he is an unsavory character. They say terrible things have been written about him online. Witnesses at the warehouse party say Pierce goes to the party with possibly an ounce of cocaine to give out. Around 4:21 in the morning, while they're still at the party, Christy and Hilda are texting, "Do you want coke? Let's do a line." According to a police affidavit, a witness observed Pierce provide what looked like cocaine to the two women who consumed it. Something happened to make Christy and Hilda not get into that Uber that they called. A neighbor reported to police they heard someone, quote, in pain and moaning on and off during the hours of 10:30 in the morning Saturday until 4 in the afternoon. So almost 6 hours. For reasons not known, the neighbor did not call the police.
Let's bring back Trinka Parada, a retired narcotic detective with the Los Angeles Police Department. Trinka, what stands out to you as a detective when you hear that the neighbors heard screaming between 10:30 a.m. and 4 p.m. in the middle of the day? Doesn't that send off alarm bells for you?
Well, hearing from the neighbors that there was moaning or screaming and disturbance throughout a daytime, I guess it depends on what neighborhood you live in, but for the normal person, that would be of some concern. Right there, it reminds me of a case in Florida where it was a drug rape situation and they were being held captive and tortured. And the neighbor heard screams during the night and didn't tell anybody, didn't even tell her husband, who was a sound sleeper. And when the young man turned up dead, she was like, "Oh my gosh, if only I had called, they might be alive." So that is disturbing information, and certainly goes to the indication of being held, either held captive against their will, or at least not in a condition to take care of themselves and yet being held. So a common thing with drugging, when somebody overdoses, either voluntarily or in a situation like this, there's a tendency to, rather than take them to the hospital, to try to let them sleep it off, or at least let it wear off, which could result in somebody making a lot of noise or trying to get out. So that information also goes to an involuntary type of condition. And a great concern, and great concern that neighbors are afraid to call, or, you know, "I shouldn't get involved," or, "No one will believe me." That's pretty sad.
Jan continued his own investigation, keeping his Instagram followers updated on his findings. Jan reached out to the owner of the warehouse, who connected him to the photographer who was working the warehouse party that night. The photographer provided photos showing Christy and Hilda in the VIP section, as well as photos showing Hilda with David Pierce. Jan was also able to obtain surveillance footage from the warehouse, which showed Christy and Hilda leaving the warehouse with David Pierce and two of his friends, Brant Osborne and Michael Ansbach, then getting inside a vehicle with them. Christy and Hilda were wearing the same clothing they were dropped off at the hospital in. Hilda in her dress and boots, and Christy in a unique white pants and a red jacket. Police also viewed the footage, which showed Pierce arriving at the main entrance at 3:10 a.m. with Osborne, Ansbach, and two other individuals. Hilda texts Christy at 4:21 a.m. asking, "Do you want Coke?" Christy replied, "Yes. Where are you?" Hilda replies, "Where we came." Response by Christy is, "I'll come to break room." Hilda replies, "Where we arrived. I'm in the kitchen. Let's do a line." At 4:35 a.m., Pierce, Osborne, and Ansbach were seen in the VIP area in the back with Hilda wearing Pierce's jacket. At 4:46 a.m., surveillance video outside the warehouse shows the group exiting with Christy on the left, Ansbach in the middle, and Pierce on the right, leading Hilda behind him. Surveillance footage from across the street of Pierce's apartment show the group arrived around 5:11 a.m. in Brant Osborne's gray Hyundai Elantra. Multiple people get out and walk towards 8641 West Olympic Boulevard. 19 minutes later, at 5:30 a.m., Christy texts Hilda with a wide-eye emoji saying, "Let's go." Hilda replies, "I'll call an Uber, 10 minutes away." 13 minutes after that, a car pulls up, which police believe was an Uber. After waiting 5 minutes, it drives away without picking anyone up. At 11:17 that morning, Brant Osborne gets into the Elantra and returns at 11:44. At 2:11 p.m., surveillance footage shows Pierce outside holding a dog, looking around. At 4:19, Pierce and Osborne are shown carrying Christy out the back door. Pierce appears to be looking over his shoulder. They're unable to carry her, so he goes back inside and closes the door. Pierce reemerges with Christy over his shoulder and is followed by Osborne down the stairs towards the Prius. In the video, Christy is limp and completely unresponsive, according to Detective Vander Lee. Pierce is wearing glasses, a Calvin Klein hat with a mask on, and an Archangel branded t-shirt. Osborne walks out with a black Brooklyn t-shirt and a pink purse, which is Christy's. At 5:15 p.m., Ansbach leaves the residence carrying bags of unknown items. 15 minutes later, the Prius is seen returning to Pierce's apartment at 5:30. At 6:37 p.m., an hour after Pierce and Osborne return, they exit the residence again with Pierce carrying Hilda over his shoulder. Osborne is carrying Hilda's shoes. But instead of driving to the same hospital, the men instead take off for Kaiser Permanente Medical Center in West Los Angeles. At 7:24 p.m., you can see Pierce near the laundry room in his apartment, next to where the washers and dryers are, manipulating what appears to be linen and clothes. In the video of Hilda being dropped off, Pierce changed his mask and his shorts. Brant Osborne changed his jacket. There is a lot to unpack there. The timing of the text messages between Christy and Hilda at the party, asking about doing a line, and then just 15 minutes later, we see them leaving the party with Pierce. We know Pierce gave them cocaine, according to their friend Dohi. The amount of time between the Uber leaving the house at 5:45 a.m. and Christy not being dropped off at the hospital until 5 p.m., nearly 12 hours. And we know from the surveillance footage that both Osborne and Pierce were outside the house at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. What took them so long to bring Christy to the hospital? And how about the woman being thrown over their back, carried out to the car, and dropped off outside the hospital? The disregard for these women's well-being, an attempt to conceal their identity. No woman deserves to be treated this way. No woman needs to go through this horrific and horrible and senseless death. And no parent should have to grieve their loss of their own child. Trinka, we don't know what happened in that apartment, and we may never know, but what do you make of the actions of Pierce and Osborne?
We're clearly dropping them off separately and at two different times. That's partly, I would think, to divert the case being put together, trying to divert a connection. But also that seems to indicate that the one may have been in worse condition and they dropped her off first, thinking, uh-oh. Again, there's this tendency to try to let them sleep it off or let the drug wear off before letting them leave. And she obviously was in a bad enough condition that they felt they had to do something. They probably left the other one behind rather than drop them off at the same time or time span, thinking she might, get through it better. And then they get back and she's going, getting into worse condition as well. And therefore the time delay, clearly, again, more trying to cover their tracks than trying to help somebody in obvious medical need at that point.
Just over a month later, on December 15th, 2021, Los Angeles Police Department announced an arrest.
Police have arrested three men in connection with the deaths of a model and her friend last month.
KCAL9's Jasmine Veal live in Olympic Boulevard in the Pico Robertson neighborhood with details now. Jasmine.
Well, Susie, this is the apartment right behind me. They're on the second floor where those two women had those fatal overdoses. And as you said, their bodies later dumped at two different hospitals. And tonight, police are concerned there could be even more women victims out there drugged by these men.
LAPD arrested David Pierce on suspicion of manslaughter. Michael Ansbach and 42-year-old Brant Osborne were both arrested on suspicion of being an accessory to manslaughter. Ultimately, the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office declined to charge the men with crimes connected to the woman's death and sent the case back to detectives for further investigation. Osborne and Ansbach were released from custody, but Pierce was also charged with four unrelated sexual assault charges dating back to 2010. He allegedly lured four different Jane Does to his apartment and gave three of them a special drink, causing them to get dizzy or black out. Let's welcome Josh Ritter. Josh is a criminal defense attorney and former LA County prosecutor and the host of Courtroom Confidential on YouTube. Josh, you have a connection to this case. How did you first hear about it?
I was having brunch with my nephew, who happens to be in law enforcement. And many times when we get together, we'll trade stories about what he's been up to in his line of work. And he happened to tell me this tragic story about how he was called out on an investigation of a case where a young woman had been dropped off close to death, if not dead already, at a hospital. And then a few hours later, another woman had been dropped off at a different hospital. And we were talking about just what a tragic story that is. The story actually made the news later that evening. And I received a phone call a few days later from a man by the name of Jan Chilliers, who told me that, in fact, it was his wife that was one of the women, Christy Giles, who had been dropped off and was dead at one of these hospitals. And that is how I originally became involved in this whole case.
The prosecutor sent the case back to the detectives. What goes into this type of decision? Did they send the case back to the detectives because the prosecutors didn't believe that there was sufficient evidence in order to prove their case? Were they not able to hold the suspect in custody any longer based on the evidence they had?
It's not uncommon for prosecutors to ask detectives to do further follow-up investigation on a case before they feel comfortable filing it. Many times, prosecutors will get a case and they'll either accept it for filing or they will reject it for filing, feeling that it's either, you know, doesn't qualify as a crime or, you know, maybe they feel like a different agency should handle it. But oftentimes, they will reject it for further investigation, meaning we're not going to file it now. We need it to go back to detectives and we need them to have some further work done. That could be lab testing. That could be follow-up interviews with other eyewitnesses. That could be pulling other evidence, you know, asking them to, you know, investigate whether or not any surveillance video exists, you know, perhaps pulling phone records, banking records, all sorts of things that a DA might feel like they need before they can file a case. And the reason behind that is they kind of know that they have one shot at this. They want to know that once they have filed on someone, the clock begins to tick. And the defendant then kind of controls the clock, as it were. And if they really push the prosecutors need to hurry up and get to a preliminary hearing within 10 days and perhaps even a trial within 60 days. So they have to have all their ducks in a row before they even make the decision to file. Now, most times that doesn't happen. Trials drag on, continuances are given, but prosecutors always kind of operate with the idea that at the time of filing, you should have all the evidence that you feel you need if pushed to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt. And if you don't, you send it back to detectives to do further investigation.
A week later, a judge ordered Pierce to remain in jail in lieu of his $3.4 million bail. At the hearing, Deputy District Attorney Catherine Mariano said investigators found $30,000 and a passport in Pierce's car when he was arrested. Mariano told the judge Pierce frequently drugged women and sexually abused them, posed a threat to the public, and is a flight risk. The prosecutors added that upon his arrest, Pierce tried to flee and ran out the back door. Investigators also found evidence that Pierce was searching about living in foreign countries that do not extradite Americans. Pierce's defense team claimed he works as a freelance entertainment event planner and lives paycheck to paycheck, so he would not be able to afford the minimum to pay the $3.4 million bail related to the rape charges. His attorney at the time, Jacob Glucksman, also said keeping Pierce in jail during the COVID surge is dangerous because Pierce suffers from pre-existing health conditions and that Pierce has not been vaccinated against COVID. Glucksman asked the judge to consider lowering Pierce's bail to $100,000 if he agreed to wear a GPS tracking device, noting Pierce did not have a criminal record. The defense attorney also explained the $30,000 found in Pierce's car was from winnings from a recent Vegas trip and that Pierce's vehicle did not have a license plate because he was involved in a car accident a few weeks before his arrest. Outside the courtroom, Deputy District Attorney Catherine Mariano told reporters the investigation into Christy and Hilda's murder was ongoing. Let's bring back Trinka Parada. Trinka, how does Pierce's alleged history come into play while the investigation into the murders continues?
Well, drug-facilitated sexual assault suspects tend to be serial rapists. They try this, it works. It works really well. And the victim can't testify, can't say, no, I said no. I would have surely said no. I but I don't remember saying no. I meant to say, you know, you hear all these things and it works. So they're not prosecuted. So guess what? They do it again and again. And it's not uncommon when you're talking about these types of cases, the weird activities with foreign objects, bottles and things like that, because it works so well to use the drugs and take advantage of somebody that's under the influence of drugs. So you really get this picture of the typical sexual predator aided by drugging, who gets kinkier and kinkier over time. The issue of the special drinks, that's very common too. We've had people convinced to try a dietary supplement. This is an energy tonic. This is great stuff. And it's really GHB or whatever concoction. Because if I'm drinking wine, I'm sitting in a bar drinking rosé wine and a guy wants to hit on me in this way, he's not going to just slip GHB in my rosé wine because I'll probably notice it. GHB is not tasteless. It has a nasty taste by itself. So he's going to have to get me to try something else. Maybe it's St. Patrick's Day and they're passing around those little green shots that are a concoction, a very strong concoction. And if I've never had one of whatever that is, I'm not going to notice whether the taste is what it should be or not. So a lot of times that special drink is to get you to drink something that they can hide whatever they're doing in. Or it may be their preferred concoction. Some people want you unconscious. Having sex with a near dead body is apparently a thrill, like the Andrew Lester case. Or maybe it's because he wants a very precise control of what he does to you. They may want you not unconscious, but memory loss. So we had a case where the magic drink was one of those three-layer different color liqueurs, very sweet, very unusual, very pretty to look at, very different. But he threw in a piece of candy, and he told them, be sure you eat the candy at the bottom. Well, the candy was an ecstasy pill, because being a stimulant and sexually stimulating, ecstasy can also be a sexual assault drug, but it's not a downer. It's an upper. So you're maybe a little less likely to pass out. Maybe you're going to be more sexually involved and appear to be participating in the videos that they often make, but you're still going to have the memory loss from the alcohol and the GHB. So these special drinks are definitely special. They're calculated. They're have a very intense purpose, and it may be anything from just knocking you out to fine-tuning the effects that they give you.
Later that month, detectives got a warrant to search dozens of phones, tablets, laptops, SD cards, cameras, flash drives, VHS tapes, and voice recorders seized from the three men. In the search warrant affidavit, LAPD Detective Jonathan Vander Lee wrote he believed the devices may show what happened that night inside Pierce and Osborne's apartment. In April 2022, the Los Angeles County Medical Examiner's Coroner's Office confirmed the cause of death of both Christy and Hilda.
The deaths of two women drugged and dumped at separate hospitals last November have been ruled homicides.
The coroner making public for the first time all of the illegal drugs found in their systems.
Christy died due to multiple drug intoxication and Hilda from multiple organ failures and multiple drug intoxication. Christy had a fatal mix of cocaine, fentanyl, ketamine, and GHB in her system, commonly referred to as the date rape drug. Back to Dusty Giles, Christy's mother. Dusty, how do you react to those findings? Do you think Christy would have ever knowingly taken some of those drugs?
No. In fact, she told me everything down there is almost laced with fentanyl, and you just don't unless you've been with, unless it's somebody you know or whatever. She was honest with us. The only way to keep an open line of communication with your child who lives a distance away, even though she's going against what everything that her mom and dad raised her and warned her and told her not to lose her roots. Don't forget your roots. And she told me that they are lacing it with everything. You've got to even be careful with if you buy, not from a distillery, if you buy marijuana from somebody on the street. And she said, so no, ma'am, you know, because I asked her straight out. But she said that she had at times taken what she called party drugs at some of the raids that they would go to. So was I surprised? I was surprised of some of the stuff in there. Yes, definitely, because she didn't do heroin. She was open and honest with what she had tried before.
Hilda's autopsy also shows traces of cocaine, MDMA or ecstasy, and elevated levels of fentanyl in her system. Both women enjoyed having a good time, but Christy's family insists she wasn't some flighty 20-year-old party girl. Jan, how would you describe Christy's nightlife?
So, yeah, I'm a member of a sort of, it's like a, I don't know if it's like a nightlife club, but it's like more of a members club, very similar to what Soho House is. And I've been, you know, we generally spend a couple of weekends there out of the month. Because all our friends are there, and it was a sort of an easy hang. You just show up, and all your friends just happen to be there. So it was a great place to catch up with everyone. And but as far as like bigger parties and bigger nightlife things, I wouldn't say we went out all the time, but we definitely had an active social life, and you know, we enjoyed a good boogie. So most of the time we went out together, but if I was busy, she'd go out with friends, and if she was busy, I'd go out with friends. So it worked out great.
Let's bring in Fernanda Cantasani, Hilda's close friend. How would you describe Hilda? Was she a party girl type?
I mean, she, of course, loved to party like everybody. I guess she loved to be with her friends and to be, you know, near some good times in her home. But to be honest, the times we were always together here in Monterrey, she was the one who was going earlier to sleep. Like, she was at 10, she was always like, oh no, I'm going to sleep now. So she went, we were always at her home. So she was like, yeah, you stay here and I go to sleep. And it was so funny because everyone was like, no, don't go to sleep. We were always like telling her to stay more. We were begging her to stay more, to stay awake. But of course, when she went to LA, I mean, we went to party, of course, here in Mexico, in Monterrey. But I don't know, she had really specific, habits. And she had a routine where she wake up really early, like at 6 a.m. She walked Tomas like for 1 hour, then she started to work. And then she went to the gym. So she had really like her routine was really, I don't know, like squared routine. She always did like at the same hours every day, like walk the dog in the morning, then go to work, then go to the gym, then eat and sleep. That was like her routine. But of course, there were times we were going to party and she loved the party like everyone. But when she moved to LA, like every other person, I guess, she was partying too. And she was also like, she was new to the town. So of course she wanted to meet new people, meet new friends. So, I mean, I would not say she was like like always partying, but like everybody, we love to party. We like to be with friends. So I guess in LA, she was just trying to get to know people and try to make her own friend circle like she did have here in Monterrey. I guess she was trying to do this.
Let's bring back Hilda's sister, Fernanda. Did you notice she was partying more when she moved to LA?
Yeah, I think it was just like maybe at the beginning, she was a bit more since, you know, all of the excitement, new things, of course, LA, everything, it's like, I don't know, like fancy, and it's very different, but that was it. I mean, she was really, really focused at work. I sometimes talked with her and she was like, sorry, I'm at work. Like, I will call you later, or I will send message later. I think she wasn't partying more than usual, same, like not more than any other young person would. I think for me, it's just, we already established that she wasn't a party girl type, but like these type of questions in general and also seeing in the media kind of, you know, make me mad, because then I think even if they were, why would that make a difference? It was a life, both lives, and also, besides the fact of the drugs, which, yeah, we know, they were just like so many other overwhelming facts that happened that night. If they would have taken them to the hospital sooner, call 911, do something to help, things might have turned like way out differently. So I think like for us, there's absolutely no doubt, or this, the fact that they were drugs involved changed nothing. For us. And I think in general, like to the whole case, right?
And now to Hilda's mother, Dr. Arzola Plasencia. What did you think when you heard about her toxicology results?
I was shocked because I never ever expected to hear that. And the night that everything came up, I spoke with a neurologist at the ICU unit. And he told me, we don't know what happened. We think that she has been drugged. There were some versions about the official version and about the hospital version. And they didn't match. And that gave us more, questions about what happened that night. Or what happened? What did really happen that night? And when one of the doctors, Dr. Cass, I do remember that name because it's very hard, and the doctor told us, you can say him Dr. Cass. He showed me the MRI and he explained me, you know, these findings in the MRI, they are not consistent with the drugs. They are consistent with the a lack of breathing with hypoxia. So there were a lot of things that we have to manage. And there were, you know, like a puzzle, there were missing pieces, but it was really shocking, was surprising. I didn't even know that kind of drugs, they could be able to be drink or to take it via, you know, via oral via. And so I was very surprised.
Let's dive deep into those results and bring in Dr. Jay Vargas, expert in toxicology and pharmacology, associate professor at California State University School of Criminal Justice and Criminalistics in Los Angeles. Dr. Vargas, can you first explain the process of a toxicology test?
Sure. So there's multiple testing modalities in a toxicology laboratory. First thing that you'll do is a screening test. These tests can be sensitive and can clue you into types of drugs that may be present in the biological sample. And those are predominantly immunoassays. And so looking at the toxicology reports here in this case, that, you know, we see there's presumptive positive results for multiple drugs. And then at that point, what the toxicology lab does is, so those types of tests are qualitative initially. So it tells you that the drug's probably there, but they're not confirmatory or quantitative at that point. So then with, if there's, you know, still suitable amount of sample, the lab will sort of decide on which drugs are a priority to analyze further. And then those will go into typically mass spectrometry techniques. So GCMS, LCMS, these are instruments in the lab that can confirm that that drug is present. And then additional testings will quantitate or find out how much of that drug is in the system. And so those tests can take, you know, several days to maybe weeks. It just depends on the backlog or, you know, other things happening in the laboratory at the time.
How would the cause of death be determined based on those findings?
The way these types of cases work is basically if a body comes in to the medical examiners, there's going to be some type of autopsy, some type of examination of the body. Samples will be collected at that point and will be sent to toxicology laboratory. And basically the whole purpose of medical examiner's office is for that doctor, that medical examiner, to determine the cause and manner of death, right? And they'll go through, he or she will go through that autopsy, that examination of the body, and look for anything that they can determine based on the anatomy, based on their examination of what has happened to that person and why that person is now dead. And what often happens is, and my sort of reading of the autopsy reports in this case is that the autopsy reports were pretty unremarkable. And when that happens, and meaning that there's not a lot of clues there of why that person has deceased, well, then it's up to the sort of toxicology department to see if there's anything there. And in this case, right, we do have positive toxicology results, multiple drugs on board in both decedents. And that information then will go back, of course, to the medical examiner, and then the medical examiner will review that and then maybe consult with the chief toxicologist of the lab. And then, you know, they'll write that into, you know, the cause and manner of death.
Can you explain the dangers of people taking these drugs unknowingly and some of the dangers the drugs pose?
Yeah. So looking at the toxicology results for both individuals, you know, we do have more information for Giles' report. And in that report, you know, when we go through it, you can see that, you know, where our screening test here, we you know, we have, you know, cocaine and cocaine metabolites, fentanyl, also positive for marijuana metabolites. And ketamine was also identified in the system as well. So, yeah, those drugs and drug levels are, you know, what the medical examiner and the toxicologist will be looking at. And my sort of lay of the land for this case is certainly the fentanyl is the big driver here. You know, it's the concentration of fentanyl in this person's system that very likely contributed to the main cause of death. The other drugs here, again, are in lower levels. Certainly, when you start to combine various drugs together, you can have issues, certainly. But the sort of low levels of cocaine metabolite, low levels of marijuana, and the ketamine that was found also lower levels as well in this case. So it does look like there was maybe multiple times in that period of the evening where the ingestion of drugs was possible. And the insidious thing about fentanyl in particular is that it does seem to be mixed into all sorts of drugs these days. Anything you can think of, it's unfortunately being sort of mixed in with all the recreational drugs of abuse, and certainly can find its way into other drugs as well. And so that's the big problem here, I think, is sort of unknowingly ingesting fentanyl.
Based on what was found in Christie's and Hilda's toxicology report, how easy would it be for a woman in her mid-20s to overdose on that type of mix of drugs?
It doesn't. I mean, anyone with these levels would succumb, I would imagine. These levels of fentanyl in the Giles report, at least, are toxic and fatal. I mean, if you look at the literature, the already starting at anywhere from 5 or 6 nanograms up to 30 nanograms, you would expect toxic levels. And, in this case, we have much greater than that. So, it's a lot of fentanyl. And I think that, it doesn't matter if it could have been a large man, it could be anyone with that amount, I think, of fentanyl in their system would be having a lot of trouble.
Is it possible to determine when specific drugs were taken?
So that's actually a really common question. Certainly, defense attorneys, prosecutors want that question answered. Unfortunately, it's not really possible to do that. You would have to know something about exactly how much of the dose was given trying to do sort of like a back calculation, to some point in time previous based on a drug concentration like that is just something that's not really possible to do. There's only one drug that is that we're, we're allowed to do that in the law, and that's actually alcohol. So alcohol in living persons, there is some wiggle room there and allowances for sort of back calculations to sort of determine what the concentration was. And then when knowing that, you could get more of like a timeline of when the drug was there. Now, that's not to say there's not literature on, dosing paradigms but those are the literature that would, maybe try to help you with that would be, under controlled environments and knowing exactly how much drug was administered, et cetera. So, In cases like this, it's really not you're really not able to put like a big timeline on that.
The investigation carried on, and 5 months later, in July of 2022, prosecutors filed new charges charging Pierce with the murder of Christie and Hilda. Here's LA County District Attorney George Gascon.
Because we knew that there were murders, and we wanted to be able to prove those. And that is the reason why we're now extending the charges to include murder. We also reached out to the community because we felt that there would be other victims, and we now have 7 additional victims.
Pierce was also charged with 7 counts of drugging and sexually assaulting, forcibly raping and or sodomizing several women, and 2 counts of providing a controlled substance. Fentanyl. If convicted, he could face up to 128 years to life in prison. Let's bring back Christie's mom, Dusty. Dusty, what was it like for you when you found out that the district attorney initially declined to charge the 3 men?
There's 7 living victims. 2 had already came forward 2 separate times under 2 separate different DAs of California. And both of them, the DA, the police investigated, arrested them, and the DA office didn't think there was enough believable information and failed to charge him either time. I can get the first time, but the second time, you've got him now two different women accusing him of the same MO. My daughter and Hilda did not have to die. There was no purpose in it. They could have arrested him before he re-raped five more women and then did what they did with our daughter's bodies for 10 hours, 12 hours. They did not have to die. He should have already been in prison for two counts of murder, you know, rape and drugging. But the California justice system, you know, I guess, like I said, it was under two separate DAs that made the decision. And I know in Christy and Hilda's case and the women of the seven living victims, they had to take it up. The detective in charge and the assistant DA assigned, it was under sex crimes, and they had to take it up every ring of the ladder before they could press charges. And that took a year of meeting with the next step, the next step, the next step, until it finally was a meeting with Gaston himself before the DA's office approved them pressing the charges on the seven living and Christian and Hilda's murder and their drugging with ample, you know, even after the coroner finished his examination and came out and said they were murdered, that was murdered. Even after that happened, that didn't start the will of justice going up further up the ring. It is a, once it gets in the Justice Department, the only person that has any rights is the defendant, is the criminal, is the suspectee. The victim, the victim's family, is, we have no say. Our rights are not thought of at all. I mean, David Pierce has hired and fired so many different lawyers and waited to the day of the trial to do it after we raised money and sold t-shirts, stickers, and trying to afford to be there every time to represent our daughter. So he knows that she was somebody. She wasn't a nobody. She wasn't some druggy walking the streets of LA that didn't have a family. Everybody has a family, first of all. But I mean that she was a real life person with a husband and a family and you know, that had people looking for her already. I'm sorry.
Brant Osborne is still charged only as an accessory to murder after the fact. He has pleaded not guilty and is out on bail. Michael Ansbach is not charged in this case. It's important to remember in a court of law that you are innocent until proven guilty. In our next episode, we'll dive into the past of David Pierce and details from other victims who have come forward, how LA County prosecutors may have had the chance to lock Pierce up before the tragic deaths of Christy and Hilda, plus what we know about the other two people involved in this, Brant Osborne and Michael Ansbach. I'm Kelly Hyman, and this is Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood, Girls Night Out.